Good morning, everyone. We have a full agenda. I'm delighted to be here. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs. It's Tuesday, May 19th, and I want to let everyone know we're going to be having meetings in this morning and this afternoon, and the two bills that I want to spend most of the time on is the hearing aid bill first and the psychologist bill. Both of those I'm hearing first. So if we don't get to the other bills, we're having another committee meeting at 3:30. But I have a feeling that we're going to be taking, for those two bills, the entire meeting, but I can't guarantee that. So with that, I'm sorry I can't be more specific, but I would like to open. I'm going to go back and forth, because when I see representatives or senators coming in, I'm going to have them speak so they can speak and then get out. So I'd like to open a public hearing on 2702.
No, 2589.
Oh, Vicki's here. All right. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2589.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2589 requires health benefit plans to provide coverage for hearing aids for enrollees under 18 years of age.
And then we'll get, I was going to have Mitch because he was only 2 minutes.
Okay. Hi.
Good morning.
Members of the committee, Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I'm so excited you're hearing this bill today, and you'll see a number of families who are here today with children who would benefit from this bill should we pass this bill. As I testified in the House, you know, my husband has been sort of supporting me in many ways because we don't get paid a lot in this job, so he's been bringing home the bacon since I have been a legislator for the last 10 years. He doesn't ask me for much other than just to be home once in a while, and he doesn't bug me too often about bills before the legislature like my constituents do, because he knows I hear enough of it at work. But this is something that touched my husband's heart, and as well as motorcycles and children with hearing aids. I'm not quite getting the two mixes together, but Madam Chair, he read some or saw a news program in December of 2006, and I still have my notes from when my husband called me, like I take when my constituents call. And he had seen a program on television that only 8 states required insurance companies to cover licensing or payment of hearing aids for children. And there are 12,000 kids per year who have a hearing deficiency. And he saw it on the nightly news, and he said, insurance companies do not consider it a medical problem. Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is a medical problem. It is a problem for these young children who are having difficulties hearing, and they cannot learn. If they do not have the ability to hear, just like a child who doesn't have the ability to see, you know, you saw those kids in class who were always squinting because they couldn't see the chalkboard, and until their parents figured out they needed to get some eyewear, the children had some learning disabilities. Well, it's the same way with children who can't hear, but imagine your life with everything in a din. You know, you can cover your ears, and it sounds very odd. So these children really need this assistance. We have been very proactive on hearing for children. We, in fact, I sponsored a bill way back when for cochlear implants and newborn infant screening, and we are doing much of that. But once we screen these children and realize they have hearing problems, then the families are on their own to fund these hearing aids. These hearing aids are very, very expensive for families. They range in cost for pretty substantially, and I think you're going to hear that. They're in the thousands of dollars, and for young children, they have to make them over again as they grow because their ear size changes. Madam Chair, this is not like orthodontia coverage. Some insurance plans cover orthodontia as an extra add-on. In the old days, pregnancy used to not be covered under insurance company plans. Then it was added, and it's pretty much regular part of insurance coverage. Orthodontia still is here or there. It's kind of hit and miss, but I'll tell you, a child with crooked teeth is not going to have trouble learning. It's the child who can't hear. And you're going to hear that today, and Representative Cannon will be here about 8:30. to testify as well. And so I just wanted to give you my wholehearted support for this legislation because it really benefits children and their ability to learn and helps these families who do not have the ability to pay for these hearing aids. So any questions, Madam Chair?
Thank you, Senator Walker, so much for bringing this forward.
Okay.
We're going to quickly just close the public hearing on 2589 and open a public hearing on 2702 and Representative Greenlake. Would you like to read 2702?
Sure. Madam Chair, House Bill 2702 authorizes the State Board of Psychologist Examiners to issue Certificate of Prescriptive Authority to certain licensed psychologists.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlake, House District 33, Northwest Portland, West to North Plains, and I'm very happy to be here. This House Bill 2702 is on the near the last steps of a very, very long journey. We looked at this bill the first time in 2005. In 2007, we had a very serious consideration of it in the House Healthcare Committee, and I actually opposed the bill in 2007 because I didn't think it was ready yet for prime time. But we had worked very hard in that interim. We continued to work very hard in the interim between 2007 and this session. We worked with the psychologists. We tried very hard to work with the psychiatrists, and you're going to hear a lot of testimony on both sides of this, I see from the list out there. To try and deal with the question is, what makes a safe prescriber? And it's a, you know, I'm sometimes a sort of theorist. This may work out all right in practice. How does it sound in theory? Is something that was very much on my mind. And we asked, why do nurse practitioners, for example, have the ability to prescribe these drugs? Why do naturopathic physicians have the right to prescribe them if they're on their formulary? How about primary care docs struggling with the question, and you may hear something from this from your own committee, about how hard it is to deal with the question of psychotropic drugs in a primary care practice? And I think we've finally come to a place where the circumstances under which we can expand the number of folks who can prescribe psychotropic drugs to include well-trained psychologists with a very specific intensive training program and other sideboards around their ability to practice and to prescribe, it seems to me, has now come to fruition. And I think 2702 in its form is a safe and effective mechanism to expand the workforce that we have for people who can deal with the significantly mentally ill folks in our community, which, as you know, community systems for dealing with folks with mental illness are strained to the max right now. And I hope you'll think about this seriously and perhaps pass it on to the floor and see if it can move further.
And thank you. Questions? Representative Maurer?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Representative Ron Maurer, House District 3. This is a very contentious issue. And I think it comes down to the core argument is about the education and what training these psychologists would get in order to be permitted to prescribe psychotropic drugs. And you know, the question to me is less about the psychologists and their training. It's about the nurse practitioners and the physicians and their training in prescribing psychotropic drugs. And if you look at their didactic portions of their training, how much do they get in the areas of, you know, psychopharmacology? And I'm not quite sure they get, I don't think there is a single course in medical school that deals specifically with this issue. I don't think there's a course in the nurse practitioner training that deals specifically with this issue. They get to it in other ways. But the number of classroom hours is pretty high. A master's degree is going to be required, and 800 hours of clinical training beyond that. is going to be required. And I think at some point we have to say, let's give it a try. And if there's evidence out there to suggest that it has not worked, then please show us. I think that really is the crux of the issue, and I would ask this committee to consider all those arguments fairly and make an appropriate decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes,
Senator Mike. Thank you. Representative Meyer, one of the opponents of the bill actually touched on something that you just said, comparing the training of the nurse practitioners to what the psychologist would do. And he said that if the psychologist went through the same type of training that the nurse practitioners did, he would feel much better about it. I mean, he would be more supportive of the bill. But so,
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I think the same argument was made a number of years ago when we expanded the role of nurse practitioners in the state of Oregon, that physicians felt that if the nurse practitioners only had as much training as the physicians had, then they would feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think it truly is a turf. It's a turf issue. And so as we expand scopes of practice, and Oregon is very progressive in scope of practice issues, and I don't think that the expansion of scopes of practice have hurt Oregonians. We have other things that cause hurdles for access, but it's not about our scopes of practice. In fact, our laws in the state of Oregon are actually, in some cases, ahead of the practice. And I don't think that this is a case where we need to hold back on statutory hurdles ahead of making this change and then allow the practice to move forward.
Madam Chair, if I might comment on that. I think what's missing is what's in this debate, what underlies it, is the undervaluation of the professional training of a psychologist before we get to this master's degree. I said as a on the Board of Trustees of the Oregon School of Professional Psychology, which eventually became the doctoral program in psychology at the Pacific University, and spent a few years looking into the curriculum that's used to train people to the doctoral level in psychology. A great deal of work on mind-body interaction, a great deal of work on the physiology of the brain. They actually, in their training to get to the doctoral level, before we're talking about the special master's program in psychopharmacology, the psychologists are pretty well trained in terms of the whole activity of the body. Then when you add to that a master's program specifically in psychopharmacology, a two-year program from a very recognized institution, which is the training arm of the California School of Clinical Psychology, and spent 2 years studying psychopharmacology specifically in its context of the mind-body interaction, it seems to me you've trained somebody that's really well qualified to be able to do this work. They're not trained to be a physician, but they're not going to be doing surgery, and they're not trained to be a nurse practitioner, but they're not going to be doing the kind of general things that a nurse practitioner is trained to do clinically. This is a very specialized clinical training, but one that seems very adequate to the job that's at hand.
Thank you.
Senator Bates?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll start by a statement, then I'll ask a question. I, like Representative Greenlee, have both opposed and supported this bill, and I've done that about five times in the last 2 weeks, both ways. So I guess
depending on who you spoke to last.
Yeah, a classic example of I'm with them. You know, it is contentious. It's a very difficult bill, and it boils down to two areas of training. And I agree with what Representative Maurer said. The first area of training is the knowledge of the medication themselves and what is appropriate treatment for the disease process the psychologist would see in front of them and selecting the right medication to treat for that. And I think that's a hurdle that can be dealt with, and I feel comfortable with that. I think the training programs suggested here are more than adequate, probably better than most primary care physicians received and better than most nurse practitioners received. The other side that I'm concerned about, though, is making the right diagnosis. And that's the part that I keep getting hung up on and have not gotten over the hurdle yet. The patient before you might have sepsis and will present as someone who's depressed. It might be an elderly female who has a urinary tract infection and might have psychological changes because of that and do. You might be dealing with a rare case of a disease called Addison's disease, which is very rare but does occur, hard to diagnose. May have an interaction from another drug. Any of us as primary care physicians or specialists can miss those diagnoses, even with our background and training, and we unfortunately probably commonly do. So the part that I'm concerned about is their ability to diagnose illnesses other than what's apparently in front of them that might be caused by another underlying difficulty. That's the issue I'm still struggling with. Nurse practitioners go through about a year and a half program that deals with a lot of those issues by getting a broader education. And one of the things that's crossed my mind, I'm not suggesting there's an amendment to the bill, is that a psychologist who wants to enter into this type of issue should be allowed to be a direct entry into a nurse practitioner program or a similar program to get a broader understanding, and at the same time get the education necessary for writing those drugs. So my question to either of you or both of you is, how do we deal with the issue I just brought up, the broader difficulty of making a diagnosis, one which we all can miss, and we're not, despite what some people think, we're not gods, we make mistakes, we miss diagnoses. How do we deal with that?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I would say you need to look back at the underlying training of the doctoral level of psychologists, and you'll have some witnesses here. Talk about, in terms of the daily life of a psychologist, with or without the prescription of psychotropic drugs, they need to make these diagnoses as a part of their daily practice. When they're dealing with the psychological dimensions of illness, including such issues, for example, as the relationship between depression and cognitive impairment, which, as you know, gets to be a very difficult issue, their underlying training is focusing on how to help them make the right diagnosis and therefore how to make that treatment. And that's not something that has to happen in the master's level. That's something that they're very well trained about in terms of that mind-body interaction and the relationship between underlying physical disease and the behavioral manifestations of that disease. So that was the point I was trying to make about undervaluating the degree to which these people are trained to the doctoral level before it comes to the special issue of the prescription of drugs. These are things that the psychologists at the doctoral level deal with in their everyday practice basically every day and have to be able to deal with the kind of diagnostic issues you deal with in order to interact with other professionals as they do in their daily practice. So, I think it's not at the master's. I think it's not the additional training that addresses the question of how to make appropriate diagnosis. It's in the heart of the training for psychologists to do that.
We have about 40 people to testify. I know, and it's now 20 after. I know that Senator Cruz has a quick question, but I really want to. There are a lot of people from the public that have come, and we are not going to be moving this bill, so you can come back and we'll have more an esoteric conversation later on. Senator Cruz.
The question, while I have this august panel here, it's been suggested that some of the opposition would go away if, for example, the training was more along the lines of DOD training. Was that discussed, or how would you react to that?
May I?
Here's our DOD expert.
That was not discussed, okay. Per se. It wasn't. But I actually want one thing about Senator Bates's question, and that is, what is the role of psychologists? Are they the primary care provider? In Oregon, we want a medical home model, primary care model. And I would suggest that the psychologist, if the psychologist is there making the initial diagnosis or differential diagnosis without a conversation with a primary care provider, I think we have a problem in our system. And that whether you're an oncologist who should be talking with primary care or the cardiologist should be talking to primary care, those conversations should be occurring. So hopefully the psychologist is not working in a vacuum. Because if the psychologist is the primary care provider for a person, then they're wrong, and that should not happen. So I think you cannot look at it as these issues come to the provider in a vacuum with no other support.
And if I could answer Senator Cruz's question, we've been meeting with the psychiatrists in their group since early in the 2007 session. We had a work session that Representative Kotek left and said, what would be the right training? Well, during the 2000 session, it was, they need to become a doctor. If they become a physician, then it's okay to prescribe. We got them off that in the interim, and the what was needed to be appropriate finally by the end of the interim was if they became a PA, then they could work under the supervision of physicians. And my answer to that was, well, how about if they did the PA training but were then psychologists with prescribing? No, that wouldn't work. So we didn't have the DOD thing, but I think their training is very close to the DOD training in terms of what that master's program is, and you'll have witnesses that can answer.
Let's do that. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
And I'm going to close the public hearing on 2702 right now, and for those in the audience, we are only going to be dealing with 2589 and 2702. Then we will be reconvening at 3:30 and hopefully be able to deal with the rest of those bills later on. So I want to reopen House Bill 2589 and call Mike Sullivan, John McCauley up.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the political director for AWPPW.
Which is, that's right.
The Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. I don't know, we just don't call it the alphabet.
Okay.
It's a lot easier. I'm here because I want to tell the story of myself. I was born with hearing loss, so I know how difficult it is. I never had phonics, so to understand sentences, words, I had to figure out what the sentence meant. And the wisdom of school in those days, my surname is Sullivan, and I always sat in the back of the room. And so, you know, I went through high school, went in the Navy, worked on aircraft carriers, got more hearing loss. Then I worked 30-plus years in a steel mill and maintained more. And I'm never alone now because I got humming and buzzing in my ears. So I'm urging you all to pass House Bill 2589 because this is a voice of experience. It's hard to learn when you're in that kind of position. And so if they can get it early on, and the help and the care they need, perhaps they won't go through the trail I did. And I'll leave you with what Ray Charles said. For him, as a blind man, deafness was the worst disability. And there's a lot to that statement, I think. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCauley. I'm here representing the Oregon Speech Language Hearing Association as the professional association of speech language pathologists and audiologists. We're here in support of House Bill 2589. I know you have a room full of real people who are here to tell you about this bill, and so I would defer to their expert testimony, but just wanted to let you know that we strongly support the bill.
Thank you very much. All right. Marilyn Hartzell and Emily McKnight and Jen Casolino. You can stay there and we'll take care of these people first. Okay. And if you want a picture, you can come out back here to get straight on if you want.
You can sit actually over here. Are you going to come up next?
Oh, wait.
She's going to.
Good morning to you, too.
Morning.
All right, who wants to go first?
Okay, I'll start. Mm-hmm. I'm Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time. This morning...
Introduce yourself and your...
I'm Emily McKnight, and this is... Can you introduce yourself? Say who you
What's
are.
Your name?
Hasko.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you. He's got a brief testimony. Do you want to do yours first?
Yes.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Parker. I will hear in AIDS, and they help me hear a lot better. They help me listen to my friends and my teachers better.
Thank you very much.
This morning, most likely, your alarm clock rang, you may have pushed the doze button once or twice, and finally you rose to start your day. Coffee, shower, the morning news, and a quick chat with someone in the house. But what if you couldn't hear your alarm clock to wake you up? What if your chat included concentrating intensely so you could read the lips of the person talking to you even before your coffee? Hearing is something the majority of people take for granted, but for those children born with or who develop hearing loss, they must live with a different world every day. My son Parker was born 10 weeks early and considered a miracle baby by not only our family, but also by a multitude of doctors. However, from very early in Parker's life, I knew that something was not right, but it was intangible. His pediatricians kept a close eye on Parker, but even after years of speech therapy, ear tubes, tonsillectomy, and numerous requests for hearing tests, which seemed to come back inconclusive time after time, I struggled with the fact that my son was different from other toddlers. In the grocery store, people would say, "What's your name?" And I would immediately interpret, "His name is Parker." His speech was virtually unintelligible to everyone but his immediate family. I thought he might have a hearing problem, but the test came back inconclusive time after time. I didn't know where to turn, and Parker's hearing loss was still undiagnosed at the age of 4. How, I wonder, did I not determine the cause before age 4? Well, he was a good faker. When the truth about his hearing loss came to light, it was determined that Parker was already reading lips and body language. Yet the truth was a huge shock. At age 4, I finally insisted on a sound booth hearing test for Parker. Immediately after the test, we were told that Parker had severe hearing loss in both ears. The doctors said they were stunned that he was talking at all. In my immense grief at the news, there was also a sense of relief. There was finally an answer to what was wrong. In fact, maybe we would avoid those embarrassing mistakes when Parker imitated the words that he heard the way he heard them, which I usually tried to avoid words like truck. We battled our pain at knowing that our son would never hear the world the way the rest of us did. He would never hear the music he so desperately loved to its fullest capacity, and knew that there would be labels he would carry throughout his life as the kid with hearing aids. We fitted Parker with loaner hearing aids, and it took only a few weeks until our agony turned to a sense of joy. Parker was a different child. He changed so dramatically, we were almost in shock. His speech changed almost immediately. All of those days of sounding like Roseanne Barr around my house were suddenly quieted. My absolute panic after screaming after Parker as he rode his bike so that he wouldn't ride into the street when he didn't respond to me at all were eased with a boy who turned to my voice and stopped. It was as though a miracle occurred. He seemed brilliant, he craved knowledge, and he was finally understood. After seeing the difference in Parker, one could not possibly think that hearing aids are not a vital necessity for children with hearing loss. This is not a partisan issue and not just another add-on for insurance companies. This is something that has been overlooked for years and is a matter of equal rights. In fact, many states have passed similar bills in recent years, and several are working on them currently. We must take care of our children. Anyone who knew Parker in his pre-hearing aid days would assure you that he has truly blossomed and is a different child. We must give every child this chance. Families should not have to choose between food on the table and hearing aids for their children. I humbly ask for your support for House Bill 2589, Parker's bill, for the sake of our children. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much. And I know what it's like to grow up with someone. My sister is deaf. She had a complete hearing loss, though, because and so was never able to use hearing aids. So I think this is just wonderful progress.
Thank you very much.
That you have with Parker.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Castellano. This is my son, Ben. He is 4 months old, and I would like to tell you a little bit about his beginning of his life and his hearing loss. Finding out your baby is deaf is being hit like being hit with a pile of bricks, invisible bricks. He was warm and soft and snuggled in my arms. He looked perfect. How could something be wrong? But at 12 hours old, I was told he failed his hearing test. Impossible. The nurses must have botched the test. But still, through the denial, I felt the pain coming from somewhere. At 2 weeks old, we took our baby to get another hearing test. He failed. The dull, throbbing pain of those invisible bricks returned. I could have sworn he flinched when we banged the pots and pans over his head, desperately trying to perform our own hearing tests. After a visit to an ENT, a different audiologist, and 2 more hearing tests, we had our answer. Our son is deaf. All the I love you whispers and lullaby tunes had truly gone unheard. He'll never really know my voice. The bricks pushed so hard I couldn't breathe. That long, deep exhale of relaxed contentment of a world full of bright futures and sunny skies that existed in the world of our son were crushed by the dark news of which I had just heard. I'm his mother. My job is to fix what goes wrong in his world. I hung on the glimmer of hope provided by the audiologist. He may be able to hear some sounds with a hearing aid. Hearing aids would be the answer. I knew it. I searched and found that with my son's severe loss, he would need high-powered hearing aids, expensive hearing aids. Our insurance doesn't cover hearing aids. We couldn't deny our child the chance to hear. Sacrifices could be made. We have a car we no longer drive. Someone might buy it. My husband could work longer hours. I could cut my maternity leave short. Those bricks grew heavier. We were lucky, blessed. The Willamette ESD loaned us hearing aids to see if our son responded to sound. On April 1st, at 9 weeks old, my son tried on his first pair of hearing aids. As we snapped the battery door shut, we held our breath. I didn't know what to say. Ben, it's Mommy. He opened his eyes. He looked at my face. He heard my voice. My son wears his hearing aids whenever he's awake. He smiles more. He enjoys patty cake and Twinkle Twinkle. We listen to Mozart. I can soothe him with my voice when he cries and he hears my goodnight whispers. If we were not able to borrow hearing aids, my child would be missing these sounds. Soon we will need to buy Ben his own pair of hearing aids. Unfortunately, the high cost of hearing aids creates a barrier for families like ours. Our insurance does not cover any of the expenses associated with hearing aids. Sacrifices will need to be made. It is not fair that Ben should have to get less expensive, less effective hearing aids, or our family have financial constraints. We paid for health insurance to cover our family's medical needs. My child's eyesight is covered. Why not his hearing? Should he be denied the opportunity to attend regular education classes, develop normal speech, and listen to Mozart? Thank you.
Wonderful story. Thank you, both of you, parents. Your stories are really heartfelt.
Thank you.
Thank you, Parker.
Okay.
And what's your child's name?
This is Ben.
Ben. Thank you, Ben.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Health and Veteran Affairs Committee. Excuse me. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you and testify in support of House Bill 2589. My name is Marilyn Hartzell. I am the director of the Oregon Center for Children and Youth with Special Health Needs, or OCEAN, as we call it. It is administered at the Oregon Health and Science University. I'm here today to share our statewide perspective on the needs of families and their children with chronic and disabling conditions, and to give emphasis to the potential benefit that passage of House Bill 2589 could have on children and families in our state. I think the job has been well done already this morning. Just a little bit about OCEAN. OCEAN is Oregon's state Title V maternal and child health program funded by the federal and state match dollars with a mandate to assure that children with special health needs and their families' needs are met. We are located in the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center at OHSU. From within the CDRC, our pediatric audiology clinic serves children from all areas of Oregon. The clinic works with the Oregon Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Program, which it assures that Oregon children are evaluated, identified, and referred for intervention due to early hearing loss, along with the regional programs for the deaf and hard of hearing, and other private and public educational programs for children with hearing loss. Our pediatric audiology clinical services include diagnosis, assistance with care coordination, and fitting of loaner hearing aids while children are waiting to be made eligible for intervention services. This year alone, just since July 1, our pediatric audiology clinic has conducted 2,598 visits. Those are primarily evaluations. More than one of every five Oregon families care for at least one child with special health needs. There are emotional and financial hardships, which you have already heard this morning. There are skyrocketing out-of-pocket costs, which you have also heard mentioned just in relation to hearing loss, including other conditions. Parents may have to cut back on or quit work because of there is no suitable child care or because of the cost to care adequately for their children. The emotional toll on families is also great, and as needs are prioritized, the parents' needs are often last, leaving parents exhausted. We have more data, and it will be in my testimony, which I will submit to you in writing. House Bill 2589 is both an opportunity to address one small area of underinsurance and to have a huge impact on the ability of families to care for their children with special health needs, children for whom hearing loss is often only one of several chronic health conditions. House Bill 2589 would assure that private insurance provide a hearing aid benefit of $4,000 every 4 years for children up to the age of 18 with authorization by a physician. In 2005 to 2006, there were an estimated 1,290 children in Oregon between the ages of birth and 17 who had unmet needs for hearing aids or hearing care. Annually, about 80 children are identified for further testing. The screening is mandated in our hospitals that experience 200 live births, but to what end? What happens after a child is diagnosed if the family is not able to purchase hearing treatment? You have heard this morning already why this is important. The ability to hear is critical to the development of speech and language. That impacts social emotional development, literacy, academic achievement, and all are intrinsically dependent on speech and language. Hearing aids should be among those choices for their long-term benefits to be accrued to children, their families, and our society here in Oregon. Currently, many private insurance companies already cover the cost of cochlear implants, and recent legislation required health benefit plans which cover a unilateral implant to expand coverage to include bilateral implants. But these are only appropriate for children with profound hearing loss who cannot benefit from hearing aids. For many more children with hearing losses ranging from mild to profound, hearing aids are the recommended and medically necessary intervention. There is precedence here in Oregon. The Public Employees Benefit Board voted last year to offer a hearing benefit of $4,000 every 4 years for all enrollees, not just children. The Oregon Health Plan covers hearing aids for children with a benefit of $600 every three years. A good start, not adequate. However, for most families in Oregon with private insurance only, there is no hearing benefit. Currently, this amounts to about 60% of our children in our state with special health needs. 12 states have already provided insurance benefits for hearing aids for children with hearing loss. We hope that Oregon may join that club. Passage of House Bill 2589 would bring our state closer to equitable coverage of hearing care for all of our children. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions?
Quick question. You have a
Yes.
You have a waiting list?
waiting list for hearing aids?
For hearing aids and for children being seen.
For children with what?
Do you have a waiting list for children to be seen and for hearing aids?
At CDRC?
Yes.
I'm not familiar with our waiting list for the pediatric clinic, but I can get that information for you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right.
Representative Cannon's here.
Okay, Representative Cannon, and then Jerry Dennehy and Sarah Leslie.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
I'm Ben Cannon, State Representative, House District 46, and thanks for hearing the bill. I want to say a few words about mandates generally. You've heard a little about this particular bill and the good that it would do a small number of Oregon families. But I want to speak to the subject, I think the bigger picture, which is this type of bill. And you heard in the session. First of all, on this bill, you're getting some information. We did ask DCBS to survey carriers about the cost impacts of this mandate, and you'll see here that the median response was that this would add 0.07% or 0.07 of a percent to the premium cost. If my math is right, that's 70 cents on $1,000. But frankly, that's not really the issue. When we think about mandates, we need to think about the cumulative impact of them. And that's something that I think we don't do enough in this legislature. We tend to deal with these in isolation. We tend to look at them sort of politically. And we need to consider, I think, frankly, the accumulation and the accretion of these mandates over time. And that's why when we discuss this in the Health Care Committee in the House, we look to the interim, why I'm very interested in surveying this over the interim, considering questions like, well, what is the total cost of the mandates that we already have on the books? Which non-mandated services provide best value and perhaps should be mandated? And which of our mandated services do not provide good value and perhaps should not be mandated? I think that is a great project for the interim, and I look forward to exploring that with members of the House Health Care and hopefully members of the Senate Health Care Committee and others as well. I think we can look at other states, see where Oregon compares, and use that information to help consider these types of bills in the future. There is one complicating factor as you consider the cost and benefit of adding insurance mandates, and it's one that I think is particularly relevant to this bill. Often proponents will say on related to a proposed mandate, well, the cost of this, the upfront sort of premium cost of this, will pay for itself in healthcare savings over time. I think that's typically the claim, and I think very often it's true. This is an interesting one. There may be others in this category because I think the savings that you're hearing about, if we're thinking just of the financial impact of this, the savings may be outside of the healthcare field. The savings may be achieved in education, the reduced need for special services and education for the children who benefit from these hearing aids at a young age. They may be achieved in the child care arena. So that payback is one that we get that the taxpayer, frankly, achieves over time. And that may be a case where there is a particular need for a mandate. Whereas, arguably, if it's a benefit the insurer and the healthcare system will experience over time from that investment and upfront cost, one could argue, well, hey, we don't need to mandate this because the insurers are going to get to it anyway. They'll realize that there's savings over time. This may be a case where those savings are ones that we experience in other areas, education, child care, even workforce-related issues. So I urge this bill upon you because of the great benefit that it will do for a small number of Oregon families, because of the modest, really minimal cost that this discrete mandate will create on premiums, but with caution and with recognition that we do need to consider the broader issue, and looking forward to interim work to put this in the context of the other bills like this that we consider, some of which we pass.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. Yes.
Well, while we have Representative Cann here, I'd like to ask him a question, sort of get on the record. There are about 20,000 codes we use to make diagnoses, some of which are covered by insurers, some are not, and probably another 5,000 to 10,000 codes we use of treatments. And when I first came to the Legislative Assembly, and as I've watched it unfold over the last 10 years, this whole thing about mandates has slowly driven me as a physician crazy. And this is another good example of something that should have happened a long time ago. But the Legislative Assembly is designed to work carefully and slowly and thoughtfully. And we look at something like this where there's very minimal financial cost to it, huge benefit to our society. You ask yourself why this had not happened before. So there's a question I'm getting to here. We also have a huge number of uninsured children in this state at this point who will not be touched by this because they haven't got health insurance. So my question is sort of rhetorical, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I want to know if you are in a position to be able to support a health policy board with the authority to interact with insurers to decide what mandates have proper benefit versus cost ratios, things that really work and don't work, and take it out of the hands of the legislature. There are times when things change so quickly in medicine that we don't respond. In the next 2 or 3 years, I believe colonoscopies, as an example, will be passe, and virtual colonoscopies will be the way we'll be going at a fraction of the cost. And this legislative assembly will probably not act on that for 5 years. And I can go through medicine over and over with these types of issues. So my question is, let's get this done today, but let's look to the future, and not with the interim committee start looking at mandates, but setting up an authority that can really take care of this in a proper scientific manner.
Well, I... Chairman Mona Sanderson and Senator Bates, I agree with that completely, that the medical profession moves and our medical understanding moves too quickly and requires, frankly, a level of expertise and study that this legislature, I don't believe, has the capacity to create. That's why not only would I support that, but I have continue to support the chair's notion of how we might deal with scope of practice issues that, I think get into areas that require more attention, understanding, deliberation than this legislature at this time has the capacity to give. Ultimately, we may have to be the decision maker on some of these things, but there ought to be a process to help inform that decision, and I think what you're describing in some sort of non-legislative, more technical body makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
Thank you. We only have a few more minutes on this bill, and we have 5 more people. So, Jerry, Sarah, and Nadine Palmater, could you make your comments brief? That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Chair and committee members, my name is Jerry Dennehy. Grew up here in Oregon. As in my wife. My wife graduated from Ashland High School, and I grew up in Grants Pass and graduated from Hidden Valley High School. The one difference I have here, as opposed to some of the other parents, is my son is 4 years old now, and he wasn't diagnosed with hearing loss. He passed his hearing test at an infant screening. And my wife is hearing impaired, but it was mostly due to ear infections as a child, so we really were careful on the ear infections. And he had no hearing loss due to ear infections. However, about a year ago, we discovered that he seemed to be acting differently, and I noticed this. We took him in, got him screened, discovered he had hearing loss, got his hearing aids, the loaner hearing aids. Columbia Regional Program was great. In October, I discovered that we have to pay for them, and I wasn't anticipating that. Went to my company. It's not a small company. It's a somewhat larger company, and asked for hearing aid coverage for my son, and they gave it to us. In fact, they opened it for all children and all adults in the company, and there was no premium increase. I don't think that that's going to be true all across the insurance companies, but there was no premium increase. And so for me, once I discovered that I got my own insurance company to do it, I was covered. But I said, if I'm going to make the effort, I want to make the effort all the way and get it for the rest of the children in Oregon. And that's kind of one difference that I have. I may actually lose more from this if it's passed than I'll gain, because my son will have better coverage if my insurance company follows a state mandate. and I might lose my wife's coverage. But I thought that was the ultimate good. And thanks.
Well, thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am Sarah Lashway, and I'm speaking in support of House Bill 2589. I'm currently a senior graduating with honors from Brigg High School. I have one here, and I think I was 2 years old and was diagnosed with a profound hearing loss. I have been mainstream for all of my school life and have recently been honored by the Statement Journal Academic All-Star, the Council for Exceptional Children National Yes I Can Award, and several local scholarships. None of my success would have been possible without the early and always appropriate news of hearing aids, which enabled me to thrive in school and, in fact, contribute to the community. Hearing aids are not and never were an option for me. They were a necessity without I could have never learned to speak as well as I do. In my experience, the general public is always shocked and appalled to learn that hearing aids are not covered by most insurance companies. So my family of six has been continuously covered by private insurance through my father's work. None of the five insurance plans have provided benefit for hearing aids for children. The language in the plan made it clear that hearing aids were considered an accessory for elderly and not a necessity for children. Over the past 16 years, my family has paid approximately $10,000 to $12,000 for the three sets of hearing aids I have needed. In every case, it was a serious hardship on my family, and by the time I was a teenager, I was very aware of this. On at least one occasion, we had to delay the purchase of new hearing aids because we simply could not afford them at the time I needed them. Recently, as my family was looking into purchasing a personal FM system for my niece and college, we were introduced to a new model of hearing aid. My first thought when approached with the new hearing aid was the cost. I know that my hearing disability has been a huge financial burden on my family, and I did not want to consider purchasing a hearing aid. I had a trial period with this new aid and was able to hear certain sounds for the first time in my life. The FM system that my family purchased was $2,500. In addition to tuition expenses, it was overwhelming to me to even consider asking my family to purchase this new aid. I communicated to my parents that even although the hearing aid was helpful, they were not absolutely necessary. It was easy to send the relief in our home as we could not purchase the hearing aid. I ask that the members of the committee would recommend the passage of House Bill 2589. I would also ask that the bill would be amended to reflect the Oregon definition of dependent. My reason for asking for this amendment is so that college students who are covered by their parents' health insurance would be able to access hearing resources that they may need to be successful in school. Thank you for your time and attention to this issue.
Thank you very much for your story, and it's your living proof of how hearing aids have made you such a successful young woman. So thank you. And regarding your amendment, I would encourage you to contact Senator Walker to see, since this is her bill, to see how that would work. All right?
Thank you.
All right. Comments? Thank you. Thank you very much, panel. Nadine Palmiter, Nancy Wilson, and Kate Wilcox. And I don't have any others to testify on this bill? Correct. All right. Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair and members of the Health Care and Veterans Affairs Committee, thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of House Bill 2589. My name is Nadine Palmiter, and I have been an educational audiologist for 31 years. I'm currently employed at Willamette Education Service District. You've heard of the scope of practice. We have about 82 children identified as infants every year, and then additional children who have progressive or delayed onset hearing loss. If I could have you look at the statistics on page one of the written testimony that I've provided, We provide services to about 300 children at Willamette Education Service District through the regional program, and that's Merriam, Polk, and Yamhill counties. Of those 300 children, private insurance with a hearing aid benefit is available to 6% of those families. Oregon Health Plan, we have about 32% of families eligible for that. Private insurance with no hearing aid benefit, that's 42% of our children and families. 20% of our families have no hearing aid insurance benefit whatsoever. I called private audiology clinics in the Salem area to get an idea of the cost of hearing aids through the private sector. They range between $1,200 and $2,500 per hearing aid. Implications for the citizens of Oregon. 62% of our children have no hearing aid benefit or no insurance whatsoever. A survey or a study done by Johns Hopkins University found that if you fit children with hearing aids and provide intervention for those children starting in the first year of life, it is an educational health care savings to your state of about $200,000. So I took the 300 children and I figured out 62% is 186 children. Multiply that by the $200,000 savings, that's a savings to the state of Oregon of more than $37 million. So the man who sat here, I don't know who it was, who said those health care savings might be realized in other areas other than the savings of the premiums for the insurance company, he was dead on. That is exactly where it's going to happen. What's working well? Anybody who had anything to do with the newborn hearing screening bill, may I thank you from the bottom of my heart. We identify children, and baby Ben back here is evidence that I fit him with hearing aids at 4 months of life. So that's a tremendous thing. We have the early intervention. We have the programs that are available so that parents can have the means to teach their children spoken language. What needs to happen? We need to have this bill so that families and children can have hearing aids.
We only have about three more minutes, so you have two others. So since we have your written testimony, that would be...
Two sentences.
You bet.
Blindness separates children and families from things. Hearing loss separates children and families from people. And thank you for your support.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is my son, Nathaniel. Good morning, and thank you for letting me come before you today. Hopefully I can...
And your name is?
I'm sorry, Nancy Wilson. I can offer a few words of some insight as to why this bill should be passed. And again, I hope to get through this without emotions. This has been a very emotional time for me this morning. I am an adoptive parent of twin boys from Vietnam, now 11 years old. Shortly after arriving in Vietnam, we learned one or both of our children may be hearing impaired. A lesser person might have turned away. But my husband and I loved the boys from the first moment we saw them, and we trusted in the counsel of family and our faith to bring them home to a better life in these United States and Oregon. It's a decision we never regretted. Over the next several years, while working with our family physician, Willamette ESD, Oregon Health Sciences University, and the Salem-Keizer School District, we came to learn that one of our sons did indeed have significant hearing loss as well as other disabilities, but it could be corrected through the use of hearing aids. The aids were offered at a reduced rate through Willamette ESD. My husband and I are both public employees, county and state, with good comprehensive dual coverage insurance, yet we learned that my plan offered no coverage and my husband's plan offered only $500 total every 3 years. The total cost for the aids represented more than 75% of our monthly income at the time. To put this into perspective, this amount represented 4 mortgage payments or 3 months of in-home child care or 20 months of car payments for just a few examples. Willamette ESD was able to provide a loaner set of hearing aids for our son's use while we saved up funds. Over the years, we have provided our previously used hearing aids to Willamette ESD for their loaner program, recognizing the financial hardship obtaining hearing aids for your child brings to a family. We did not plan on adopting a child with special needs. Just as biological parents do not plan on having children with special needs. But God has a plan, and we do the best we can. We have always felt privileged to have secure employment and insurance. Yet, It is not sufficient to provide our son with the hearing aids he has needed or to allow him to keep up with the ever-growing technology available to him with insurance limitations. I cannot even begin to imagine the fear of a parent who has little or no insurance to cover a child or multiple children with hearing impairment. We recently purchased for him an FM system, which is not covered by insurance, but was needed, so once again we had to save up the $2,500. This was crucial to his continued education and success, not only in the classroom, but in his social life as well. I truly hope that House Bill 2589 passes, for it's about the children. And without this, many children, will struggle to communicate, learn, and thrive. We have seen our son improve with each new piece of technology, which becomes available to him as we can afford it. I would hate to think of Nate's life had we not adopted him at 4 months old. I'm excited to see all that he will now be able to attain with hearing aids. Thank you.
And thank you for being the parents, the good parents that you are. Your sons are definitely blessed.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kate Wilcox. I'm with the Department of Human Services Office of Family Health. I'm in the Public Health Division, and I'm here to provide the public health perspective on House Bill 2589. The Office of Family Health is the home of Oregon's Early Hearing Detection Intervention Program. This is the mandated program to ensure that all children, all 49,000 of them born in Oregon, are screened for hearing loss by age one, or by 1 month of age, diagnosed if needed as early as 3 months of age, and referred into earlier intervention no later than 6 months of age. And certainly Ben is a testimony to the advantages of that regime. We see firsthand the range of barriers that families encounter in receiving the appropriate treatment for hearing loss to their children. This is one barrier that we can remove today that will help the families of Oregon. To keep this brief, Public Health, along with the partners of CDRC, OHSU, and all the families here and the audiologists and providers, we hope that you will support this bill for the benefit of our children. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We want to also read into the record, you have written testimony from Kristen Knight, OHSU, and Matthew and Kathy McCauley. All righty.
Madam Chair, I also have one from a parent, Janet Donnelly in Eugene, Oregon.
Okay.
I am writing in support of 2589.
Excellent. All right, this bill will be coming back, and I will thank you very much for coming, everyone, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2589 and open a public hearing on 2702. You already read it into the record, and I'd like to call up Glenn Alley, Laura Smith, and Robin Henderson.
We got representatives.
Oh, we got representatives. All right, Tina Kotek, Senator Nelson, and Bill, Representative Kennemer. And make it quick, because we can hear you anytime. I would really... We only have 45 minutes left, so I want to hear the public.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29. This is 2702.
Yes, it is.
I'm here in support of 2702 just from a rural perspective. We have very few psychiatrists in my district. I cover 114,000 people, obviously. This is about access. Psychologists in our area are pretty active. We have a lot of mental health problems. We just do not have psychiatrists. I got a phone or an email this morning from some guy in West Virginia saying this is a bad bill. I'm saying, what's a guy from West Virginia to know about what's going on in Oregon? This is about access for rural care. That's why I'm so passionate about this bill. And I think the psychologists have worked hard on this bill to work with the psychiatrists. And I've talked to the Portland psychiatrists and said, doggone it, this is really not, you shouldn't be doing this. But then I say, well, why don't you bring your practice or something out to Eastern Oregon so we can have a little access to care. But we don't have psychiatrists in our area. We need some more immediate care so these people don't have to keep putting off their treatment, and I think there's enough safeguards within the bill. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll get out of your
way. Oh, thank you, Senator Nelson.
Be careful what you say about West Virginia. You might upset the president.
So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for hearing 2702 today. Just some brief comments. Back in the 2007 session, I was chair of the Subcommittee on Health Policy in the House, where we heard House Bill 2800, which was the bill back in the last session. And we worked that bill very hard. It came in to our committee. We had work groups, bipartisan work groups, who brought all the stakeholders together. And we did come up with a better bill then, passed out of the committee, never made it out of Ways and Means. But in the interim, the psychologists in particular went to work to even strengthen the bill further. And I know you spoke with Representative Mauer and Representative Greenlake earlier about all the sideboards and the protections, and it's even a better bill than last time. And I think the psychologists should be applauded for their effort to engage in the scope of practice discussion, the chair's process that we were trying to get started in the interim about looking at both sides of the issues. We are never going to have complete agreement on the stakeholders on this one. We had 47 votes in the House. We didn't get every vote in the House, but that's a strong statement that this is worth a try, that the safety safeguards are in place with the way the bill sits now. I would like the psychiatrists to continue to be engaged with participating on the formulary board and making sure this goes smoothly. We're going to get a handful of psychologists across the state who want to do this. And it might not seem like a large number, but it's going to have a huge impact on their communities. Back in 2007, one of the testimonies I remembered the most was a primary care physician from Eastern Oregon who said, I need this for my community. I don't want to be the one doing all the prescribing all the time. I want to work in collaboration with my psychologist down the street to serve the mental health needs of my community. We have communities who want this. I think the safety elements are there. It's worth trying. We have not, from my understanding, heard of any other safety issues in any of the other states who do this. It's based on the Department of Defense model. It's really a good bill, and I urge your full support. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kenemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. State Representative Bill Kenemer, District 39. And I'd also point out I'm a PhD licensed psychologist, currently inactive. I know we're in a hurry, but I think this is an important bill, and I'd like to lay out a little bit of the groundwork from my carrying speech, but I'll try to make it within about 3 minutes. I'm not sure I can get it done that quick. I think there are some fundamental issues that we've been striving in the legislature to achieve, and I was back here when we began with the Oregon Health Plan back in the 80s. And it's been fun to come back, fun and challenging and disappointing and exhilarating and lots of different stuff, to come back and see the progress that we've made and be troubled by some of the lack of progress as well. But I think we're moving in a lot of directions, and I think the goals that most of us have in this legislature regarding reform and changes in healthcare, 2702 is consistent with. Let me talk about those. One of them is we realize there is a need for improved access. We all know that the psychiatric community is a small group, and it's hard to access them, and hard to access them for any period of time other than a very short meeting, typically. That's a problem. And it's a problem whether you're talking rural, which Senator Nelson just expressed very clearly, or even urban. It's an access. And incidentally, this will be a drop in the pond. Not all 1,400 psychologists will do this, maybe 5% or so. So it will be a small addition, but an important addition that will touch the lives of those people. The second is that I think psychologists are held in high esteem because we have high training standards. You have to have a PhD or a PsyD. That's 4 years of post-baccalaureate training. And then in order to be licensed, you have to have an additional, and you've had one, at minimum of one, and most of us 2 years of predoctoral supervision, you have a full postdoctoral year of supervision. So you have 5 years of training, plus you've passed some exams and been awarded your license by the state. And that's a prerequisite to even being a psychologist, not a prescribing psychologist, just a psychologist. And then under the terms of this bill, and incidentally I'd like to thank Representative Kotek, who worked to make the bill from last session much different and much better. And incidentally, Phil Barnhard pointed out he introduced this bill in a different form back as early as 2001 and every session since. So this has been around for a while. Is that in order to do this program, you have to have, after you've been licensed, 2 years of experience before you can pursue this. And then you have to have a 2-year degree in pharmacology. And incidentally, this isn't an online program. It's going to be a full university type of 2-year degree. And it's in psychopharmacology. And you follow that with a minimum of 800 hours of supervised experience. That's nearly half a year of someone who's already a practitioner. And all of that, I think, prepares people to be psychologists who can prescribe. But we're also governed by statute, which says the state ethics, that the National Association's ethical standards apply. And that is, you cannot do anything that you are not competent to do. So you must be very careful that if you're going to be prescribing or treating people, that you work collaboratively and that you refer as appropriate, and that you have the skills to make those judgments. Just as I did, thousands of referrals. I detected in an early diagnosis things about cancer and all kinds of things because I sat for 50 minutes with people. And I would point out, 85% of the prescriptions in this state come from GPs, physician's assistants, and nurse practitioners, very few of whom are experts in mental health. This is the huge trade-off that you're working on. I think it's safe. The psychopharmacology formulary will be narrow. It will be about psychopharmacology. We won't be treating your cold or your appendicitis. And incidentally, because of concerns for children, there's even in Section 7, Sub 3, a special requirement that if you're working with children, that that be supervised beyond your ordinary requirement to treat ethically. It's efficient. It was very inefficient to work with patients and try to collaborate with a GP who's doing 10-minute intervals with their patients and having trouble coordinating that. And we also know when people are in crisis, their medical needs change very dramatically, even within a day or a week or a month. It's less costly. Psychologists are less costly. I think this is an innovative bill. We did nurse practitioners years ago. This is the kind of thing that makes sense for Oregon. And it's been tested with no problems in Louisiana for 5 years, New Mexico for 5 years, and the military for 15 years. But finally, this really integrates. We've been talking, one of the major goals here at this body is to integrate physical and mental health. This bill does it. You have experts in mental health who will now have expertise, not be experts, but expertise in psychopharmacology, frankly more than 85% of the prescriptions that are coming. These people will have that combination. They will make differences in this world and improve people's lives. And the data is in. We've been talking about doing things for healthcare reform that are data-based. We know that therapy alone, medication alone, is not as effective as both combined. This is the alternative, provides that. This is, we've been talking about integrating mental and physical health. This bill does it. This is a greatly improved bill over 2007. We worked towards consensus at the 11th hour. That did not work. I am sorry. I've offered the olive branch. It's not been accepted. But I think we make turf choices. We've made it with the DOs, the naturopaths, the nurse practitioners, the chiropractors. You go on, the licensed counselors, the social workers, on and on. This is right for Oregon. It does the kinds of things we're trying to do for health care reform, and I appreciate your patience in letting me go on, and I'm
thank you.
Done.
All right.
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. No questions at this point, I don't see. And with that...
and I'm always around the hallways.
All right. We'll call you if we need you. Since we've given 30 minutes to the proponents, I want to give equal time to the opponents, but I still want to get... and there are seven proponents that are more than 100 miles. So let's call Chris Adlerud, Rob Kofelt, and Mario Marquis. Let's start with that panel. Then we might go to the opposition, so we go back and forth.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Onderud, and I have come today to tell you my story of my son, Alex. Alex is now 23 and a successful engineer working for Boeing. but his childhood was anything but an easy ride. By the age of 5, Alex was seeing a psychologist. We first noticed and thought that he was having depression, and his mental health issues became more and more severe. And for me, there are 4 real fundamental issues here as a consumer of the mental health services. One is availability of care and continuity of care, and the cost of the multiple layers that we now have, and the quality of care. For my son, Alex, we started with a psychologist because that's who the school recommended that we see. And the psychologist, after seeing Alex week after week, 1 hour every week, said, you know, I really think that Alex might be helped if we looked at some medications. He's also attention deficit and obsessive compulsive. And so we went to his primary care physician, and the physician said, you know, I'm not comfortable treating children with mental health issues and psychotropic drugs. And so then we were referred to a psychiatrist. During this time, it's the psychologist who continues to see Alex, continues to know him, to know what his needs are, to understand him as a person. And it took us almost 4 months before we were able to get in to see a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist we saw for 30 minutes, and we could see the psychiatrist every 6 to 8 weeks for 30 minutes. And frankly, we had to tell our story over and over again because folks weren't on the same page. Unfortunately, when Alex was in second grade, we moved, and we had to start this process all over again. By the time Alex was in middle school, he was on a myriad of different drugs that had been prescribed by the psychiatrist, and he had started having seizures, 20 to 30 seizures a day. So in addition to his physician and his psychologist and his psychiatrist, we added 2 neurologists to his team of practitioners. My job as a parent was to try and coordinate all of these people. I'm educated. I'm fortunate that my husband and I both worked in public service and had good health care. Many people don't. And what we determined after he was sent to OHSU and Dornbecker to find out more about the seizuring that he had, they said they had never seen anything like it before. And finally, the determination was made that it was the chemical cocktail of medications the psychiatrist had prescribed that was causing the seizuring. And that itself had a great impact on Alex in terms of his success in school. He struggled, and he looked towards his psychologist as the person who he trusted and who really was the person who provided him the best health care possible. Even today, at 23, living in Seattle, he will still call and make phone consultations with his psychologist when he is feeling like he needs to speak with somebody. He has a connection with this person, and his psychologist was excellent in terms of coordinating with his psychiatrist and with his physician, and making sure that everybody was on the same page. We lived in the metropolitan area in that we lived in Eugene for most of this time, but when we lived in Roseburg, we actually lived in Glide outside of Roseburg, and accessibility was a huge issue. There aren't many practitioners in the Roseburg area that treat children, and finding the right person is very, very difficult.
Could you sum up then?
I would just say that, you know, I support the legislation. I think that it's good for Oregon, and it would have made a huge difference for my son.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Good morning.
My name is Rob Kaufeld.
I served in Iraq, 04-05. I suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. It's became a problem. I'm getting help with my psychologist, but he cannot prescribe me the medication I need. He can suggest something. I have to take it up to the VA when I can get an appointment to see my doctor, who doesn't really know my mental state as well as my psychologist. I tell my doctor, this is what I'm suggesting from my psychologist. What do you think? He may accept it. He may not. He might want proof. Then I'm doing big circles about how to get help with my medications. If my psychologist could prescribe to me, he could simply say, this is what we could start with. This would work well. And I can try it, and it's working. I report back to him every 2 weeks, and we can make adjustments a lot quicker than the 3 to 6 months it takes to get into making a VA appointment with your doctor. The post-traumatic stress has really affected my marriage. It's made me scared with my children sneaking in my room at night. I'm sure you've seen my video I've made. I've hurt my wife. I've hurt my wife in my sleep, unintentionally unaware. I've recently performed first aid on her in my sleep, don't even know it. And my 7-year-old has seen it. He is scared to sleep in my room with me if he's on the weekends when he does that. I called my doctor team at the VA, said I'm having some serious issues. They said, well, I'm sorry, you see a private psychologist. Go see him. I'm like, okay. But, you know, if I could just call my psychologist, he could say, well, okay, if you're having these problems, maybe we need to check and adjust your dosages. The VA didn't tell me that. I do like the VA doctor I have, but he does not mentally know me as well as my psychologist. I really support this bill, and I hope it passes.
Thank you very much. Thank you, and thank you for serving our country.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mario Marquez. I'm honored to introduce myself as a prescribing psychologist from New Mexico. And I have the honor of working with children and adolescents in a rural area of our state. And moreover, I'm pleased to say that I work with the poor and the underserved children and families, the vast majority who are on Medicaid. And I want to let you know that I've worked as a psychologist working with children for about 25 years. And when I took the training, the licensing, went through all the credentialing that is necessary to gain this prescriptive authority, I just continued my work with children, but now I have an additional tool to work with the children and the families that I see. I work in collaboration with their primary care providers, mostly physicians. And I can tell you that they are very pleased to have the assistance in working with these children and with these families. These are very difficult cases, and primary care docs don't have a lot of time to see patients and their families. And so I've gotten a lot of support from them. I've established relationships with laboratories, with pharmacists, and other professionals in the area that I work in order to be able to provide high-quality behavioral health care to the patients, the children that I see. I think you may know that appropriately trained psychologists are working throughout the United States of America, in the military, in New Mexico, and in Louisiana for the past approximately 15 years. And during the last 15 years, not a single negative complaint has been registered against any of the psychologists who prescribe. That is an amazing track record of safety, and it should put to rest any false accusations that we are a public health hazard. I do not consider myself a public health hazard. I have a copy of my license in New Mexico to practice psychology. I have a license from my state to be able to prescribe psychotropic medications. I have a license from the Board of Pharmacy in my state that allows me to prescribe. And I have a license from the Drug Enforcement Administration that allows me to work in the areas that I work at. And I can tell you that we are safe, we are competent, and we are effective. In New Mexico, we have approximately 20 or so psychologists that are prescribing, and it makes a big difference in those communities.
Is your training similar to what the what is set forth in our bill?
Yes, ma'am. It's very similar, including the doctoral level in psychology and the additional psychopharmacology training and the additional clinical experience.
Thank you.
It's very similar. Yeah.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Doctor, for coming all this way to speak to us today. I appreciate it. I'm sure you're very busy and appreciate your time coming up. But could I ask you a couple of questions?
Please.
You say you work with the primary care physicians involved with these children. Do they do a physical screening on them before you see them or as you go along? What does that seem like when you're actually there in the field working?
Very happy to say, absolutely. That's one of the first requests I have from the families and the children, that they go back to the primary care doc, get a physical examination, and do some basic blood laboratory work before I even prescribe. And as a matter of fact, I'll speak with the primary care provider and ask them, is there any contraindication to me prescribing what I'm proposing to prescribe? Beyond that, I'm very, very happy to tell you that I have been able to take a lot of children and adolescents off the medications. The right to prescribe is also the right not to prescribe. And as psychologists, we have other techniques, behavioral techniques, psychotherapy, family therapy, marital therapy, that we utilize. To us, psychotropic medication is used as a last resort. It's not the only technique that we use. In fact, it's the last technique that we use. So not only is it the right not to prescribe and use our traditional psychological techniques, it's also the authority to unprescribe when appropriate. And that understanding has helped me immensely to be able to help the children that I work with. And I can assure you that the Oregon-trained psychologists who become licensed to provide this service will feel the same way, because we're primarily psychologists. There's been some discussion here about, well, you know, go to medical school, go to physician's assistant school, go to nurse practitioner school. Well, fact of the matter is, we're not interested in being physicians. I'm not interested in being a physician's assistant. I'm a psychologist. I work with children. And to me, it's an honor to be able to work with those children. And so many of us have come to believe that now we're embattled in a moral struggle to be able to provide high-quality behavioral health care to those who need it the most and receive it the least. One or two points, and I know we're pressed for time here, but what I wanted to say was that there are many other healthcare professionals in our country that are prescribing in their areas of expertise that have not attended medical school. And God knows where our country would be if these so-called mid-level practitioners were not around to assist. I think our country is going more toward a primary care model, medical home, which includes a team of practitioners. And this falls right along that same model, using psychologists to prescribe. And just to close up, I want to say that this is an idea whose time has come. As I mentioned, it's been going on for about 15 years in one form or another, and not a single negative complaint has been registered against any of the psychologists. This shouldn't be about TERF. This is about the citizens of Oregon who need quality behavioral health care, and the psychologists in Oregon who are stepping up to the plate and taking a proactive approach to this problem. They are actually addressing the mental health crisis in this state, and they're doing it at no cost to the state. So I urge you that this is no longer an experiment. It's being done as we speak. It's being done in New Mexico and Louisiana and in the military. And it's being done safely. It's being done effectively. And I have the utmost confidence in my Oregon colleagues that they will step right in line and be able to help people and improve lives in this beautiful state. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right. With the next panel, I'd like to the opposition. Should I start with John McCulley, John Bischoff, and Chris Lackey?
This is fun, Laurie. Thanks a lot.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm representing Oregon Psychiatric Association, and Chris Lockey is going to make the primary presentation on our behalf, and then Dr. Bischoff, who is the president of the Oregon Psychiatric Association, will have some comments as well. And then I will discuss with you an amendment that we weren't able to get presented in the House. In your packet, I'm giving you a copy of the scope of practice document that the psychologist completed and we responded to, so you have a copy of both the input from the organizations there. You also have a copy of Dr. Lockheed's presentation that he is going to make as well. We hope he's going to make that presentation.
Okay, working on it. Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I ask a question?
Yes, please.
I didn't quite hear what you said. Were you not allowed, or you said you were not able to give this presentation to the House?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, excuse me, Senator Bates, the hearing in the House, I think we had two witnesses who were able to present before the committee had to leave. It happened at 5 o'clock. At that point, the chair and one member of the committee was left, and we did not present the amendment at that time with no one else there to hear the presentation. So that is how it occurred in the House, and so we made the decision that with no one on the committee to hear the testimony, that we did not proceed with the amendment. It was offered to individual members of the committee, was sent to the committee staff and to the chair, but there was no action taken on it.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, this has been a new and inspiring experience for me. Thank you for the opportunity, for your time, and also for your dedication to Oregonians. Today I'm going to talk about the concerns we have about House Bill 2702. Let's see here. Oops. The bill is founded on 3 points: inadequate medical training, inadequate medical oversight, and the misunderstanding of barriers to medical care. First, the bill does not provide the training to ensure safe and effective medical practice. Proponents of the bill compare their training to that obtained in a Department of Defense training program, yet look at the difference in the number of academic hours of the two, 250-plus hours. In the first year alone, the Department of Defense participants actually had 3.5 times the number of hours required of this bill. When you compare the training to the amount of prerequisite science classes medical practitioners are required to take even before getting into to a training program such as nursing or medical school, the difference is even greater. Surprisingly, the program allows students in this bill to take courses over the phone. When you ask yourself, would you trust an airline mechanic who completed an abbreviated program over the phone? This is particularly concerning, I think, in populations who have the greatest need for quality care, such as children, older adults who often have many comorbid illnesses, and those with severe mental illness. Please note this bill would allow medical practice on children and those other groups with just 12 hours of specialized training. Secondly, the bill would create a closed system for oversight with no medically trained members. This board would oversee the functions listed there on the slide, including the development of training curriculum, formulary, and monitoring of medical practice. Nowhere else in medicine and medical practice does a board without content expertise set training curriculum. Nowhere else in medical practice does a board without medical knowledge set a formulary. Nowhere else does a board without medical expertise license and monitor medical practice. And nowhere else and medical practices at board do all of these things with no external accountability. What is the financial impact to the state? Isn't it a conflict of interest to let a trade association pay for the board? An accountable educational and monitoring system would have a fiscal impact to the state, just as it should, to ensure that there aren't conflicts of interest. You see, the estimated cost of a similar bill in 2007 was about $206,000. What is the estimated cost of this today?
I believe, and we'll have the proponents come forward, that there are grants from the national organization that was supposed to take care of the fiscal that came up. Go ahead. Yeah.
And I think, lastly, it's important to talk about access. As you are aware, providing quality medical care for all has been very challenging, despite that we as a nation spend 2 times more per capita than any other nation in the world on health care. Be sure, the solution is not going to come from the prescription of more medication. Instead, it will flow from a collaborative effort with all involved in medical care. And just as an aside, I had another slide that I took out that shows the overlays where psychologists and psychiatrists practice in the state of Oregon, and they're identical. They're clustered in urban areas. That's something important to know about. For example, data shows that the mental health of communities improve when there are collaborative efforts between primary care providers and mental health providers. The public prefers to have comprehensive care, including mental health care, from primary care centers. You will have a handout, you're receiving a handout from the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and the Oregon Pediatric Society that talks more about the benefits of these projects. Some of the other programs include telepsychiatry at OHSU, the collaboration between OHSU and the state hospital, which I am a part of. I'm assistant professor at OHSU, but also an attending psychiatrist at the state hospital. A new psychiatric residency training program in Corvallis, and a new medical school in Lebanon, Oregon. We think there are better alternatives. For example, one of the 3 pathways already in place to allow the practice of medicine in Oregon: the PA program, nurse practitioners program, or medical school. A 4th program might be based on, let's say, a PA model or the Department of Defense program that I talked about earlier. Dr. Bischoff here is going to talk more about the alternatives, but before, I'd like to close in saying that I believe this bill effectively codifies the stigma that is often associated with mental illness. That is to say that somehow Oregonians with mental disease don't deserve the standard of care that we expect in other areas of medicine. This is not a turf issue. It's not a decision about what's the bare minimum training necessary. This is really about what is the standard of care that we expect, and how do we go beyond that? Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Bischoff.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm John Bischoff. I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm, for the next few days, still the president of the Oregon Psychiatric Association, and it's my privilege and pleasure to be here to testify, and thank you for your time. John McCulley actually is going to present the details of the consensus compromise, the efforts that we've made to try to work on ways that psychologists could obtain prescribing privileges with adequate medical training, education, supervision, and oversight. I'd like to make a little bit more of a direct comment about the issue of, it was brought up earlier by one of the proponents, morality and ethics. And Chris actually, I think, stated it well, that to accept a substandard level of training, education, and supervision and oversight for medical practice is really, I think, inadvertently giving in to the stigmatization of people with mental illness. Folks have emphasized how this would give better access to people in public systems of care. I've worked my career in public systems of care, in direct service and also in medical administration. And one of my passions is insisting that the level of care that people receive in public systems is as high or higher than I would expect for myself or for a family member or for a trusted friend, colleague. Because the people we serve deserve it. They deserve a high standard of care. There are access issues in medicine, generally. Not specific to psychiatry. There are solutions out there that improve access to not only psychiatric specialties, but all medical specialties, and they don't involve allowing a substandard level of medical education, supervision, training, and oversight. And so lastly, also on a personal note, I want to do what is probably the most powerful thing to combat stigma. The Chicago Consortium on Stigma Research has shown that the way we combat stigma best is through personal contact with people with mental illness, and that that contact has a high degree of what's called disconfirmation of stereotype. So, I want to tell you that I'm a person with a mental illness. I was diagnosed with a pretty serious depression last fall. I sought a consultation with a psychiatric colleague who I trust, psychiatrist. He referred me to a psychologist who prescribes medications. She is also a skilled, experienced, well-trained, well-supervised psychiatric nurse practitioner. She also has extensive years of training and experience as a nurse. She has a solid grounding in medical training. My colleague would not have referred me to her. I would not have accepted the referral if that wasn't in place. So in all my work, I ask myself, what's appropriate for me? What's the standard of care for me? What's the standard of care for my family, right? What's the standard of care for the people who I serve? And under the provisions of this bill, the standard of care would not be met. I wouldn't refer a colleague, I wouldn't refer a family member, I wouldn't refer a person who presents before me with a mental health difficulty to a psychologist trained under the provisions of this bill. So I really appreciate your time and your patience, I encourage you to do, what you think is best regarding this bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm just going to briefly talk about a couple of things. One, when we...
Introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry, John McCulley again, Oregon Psychiatric Association. We have... I think, as Representative Greenlee may have said when he gave his testimony, was talking about our previous approaches to this when starting back in 2001. I think when we had said, well, the only way that this should happen is for psychologists to go to medical school. That position was softened significantly over the next few sessions, and I think we had come to the conclusion that nurse practitioner training or PA training, physician assistant training, would be most appropriate. And as a matter of fact, we had discussed this during the time Representative Kotek mentioned in the 2007 session. The head of the Department of Psychiatry at OHSU had offered the idea of a physician assistant training track for psychologists. That was rejected. We had a previous amendment this session that we had discussed as a possibility that would have done exactly that. The chair of the House committee did not like that. The physician assistants did not like that, and the psychologists did not like that. So that appeared to be going nowhere. So we developed another approach, and this is a -4 amendment that I had mentioned previously, that would create a group to determine what is the best training program, and our -4 amendment says that it should be based on the physician assistant model. As we have reviewed further the Department of Defense model and reviewed the the report from the American Academy of Neuropsychopharmacology, the one that was contracted by the Department of Defense to review the psychopharmacology training program there. We also thought that maybe there were some possibilities with that type of a training program because of its intensity of one full year of academic training, one full year of clinical training. We thought that could be appropriate. And what we would like to see happen is the opportunity to explore these alternatives, since we don't believe that the training program offered through the bill is adequate. We would like the opportunity to bring other stakeholders into this process. So far, it's been the psychologists and psychiatrists duking it out, but there are others who have interests in this area, including consumers. And we would like to put together a group that includes all of the interested parties and consumers to see if we can develop a training program for Oregon that will meet this need. And by saying that, it is clear we are going against what our national organization believes. They think that the only way a psychologist should be able to prescribe medication is to go to medical school. I think that our group has come to believe that there is a way that this can be done safely, and we would like the opportunity to explore that further.
Thank you very much. Questions?
All right. I plan to go as long as possible. I know session starts at 10:15, but I want to hear everyone that is here. So I'm going to go back to the proponents, Morgan Simmons, Linnea Lindsay, and Jim Wade. Please, whoever.
All right, I'll lead off then. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's an honor to be here. For the record, my name is Morgan Sammons, S-A-M-M-O-N-S. I'm a psychologist.
Hey, okay.
I am a retired Navy captain. I was a prescribing psychologist for most of my career in the military. And I was one of the first participants in the Department of Defense Psychopharmacology Demonstration Project. I was also born in Walport and raised in Ashland, so I claim quite a bit of Oregonian background. I would like to speak because some issues have been raised about the project in which I participated. I'd like to give a little bit of background information about that. First, Dr. Lockheed's figures were a bit off, although it's a bit hard to calculate contact hours in that environment. The eventual curriculum in the DOD program is probably closer to 660 contact hours. That program evolved starting in 1991 from what was essentially an off-the-shelf medical school curriculum. People were very opposed to having us do this, and they said the only way we know to train people is to send them to medical school. So that, in very large part, is what we did. We had nothing specific to training people, psychologists, to prescribe. We took the vast majority of the medical school curriculum, and that was it. And we did some rotations on inpatient psychiatry wards, which was an excellent experience. So that's very good knowledge, but it wasn't really germane to what we were trying to accomplish. And the problem is, and was then, and still remains, that in the didactic medical school curriculum, the amount of knowledge you get about psychopharmacology is vanishingly small. Anywhere from about 8 to 15 hours in the context of a course in clinical pharmacology in most instances. We wanted something that was much more specific that would build upon the prior training of psychologists and expand our knowledge considerably in that area. As a result, we then began to negotiate with the proponents of this project that the curriculum be modified to meet the ends of training psychologist prescribers. We never quite got there. Our curriculum was still very, very heavily medically oriented, But we were able to build in some more courses that were specific to training psychologists to prescribe. And we were able to delete a lot of courses that were purely extraneous to this, to that enterprise. You don't have to go through a very long sequence in gross anatomy and detailed dissection of various body parts to learn how to prescribe psychotropic medicine. It's great knowledge, but it's not really pertinent, and it's not an efficient way of learning what we had to learn. That program ended in 1997. It was a demonstration project. There was a lot of political opposition, and that eventually succeeded, and the program ended. After the program ended, those of us who had graduated were able to continue to practice in the military, which I have done until I retired from the military last year. And none of us, there was never any evidence that any of us were practicing outside any standard of care. Dr. Bischoff said that his highest ethical standard would be his level of comfort at referring a patient to a colleague. And I am proud to say that I treated many family members of psychiatrists who were my friends and colleagues in the military. So I think I met their ethical standards of care and what I also would use as a standard for referring a patient. There are now various versions of this DOD curriculum, which I said was highly medicalized, and then has been adapted to purely meet the needs of psychologists trained to prescribe. Most of these curricula right now center around 450 hours. In my estimation, as it was, as it has been for some time, I think that that is more than appropriate, given adequate clinical training, to allow these people to do this safely and effectively. The proof is in the pudding. Psychologists have been prescribing for a long time now in various settings without adverse incident, without deviations from standard of care. And I think those are the data that we should pay most attention to. I know I have other colleagues who wish to speak, so I think that I'll stop at that point and be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Matt, very much for coming. Please go ahead.
I'm Jim Wade, Madam Chair, and the committee. I appreciate being, having the opportunity to speak to you about this bill, which I strongly favor. I've had considerable experience both receiving and delivering medical education through my over 50 years in medicine, over 45 years in rural health care out of Hood River, Oregon. I practiced psychiatry in the Navy for 3 years before I got out and studied to become a boarded family practitioner. I was also a clinical instructor at OHSU Medical School, teaching students. So just by way of saying that I have some understanding and expertise in medical education and needs for providing care. I had the opportunity to study for 2 years with my son, taking this program from Alliant California University, and I was very impressed with the degree of education that was provided there. Contrary to some of the things you've heard today, I feel very strongly that this is a very adequate program. One doesn't need to know how to deliver babies in order to become a prescribing psychologist. One needs to understand the newer role that is now known about chemical interaction in the brain, the psychotropics that we didn't know about when I started. When I was practicing psychiatry, we had two drugs. Now it's considerably different. But this is like a mini medical school course that they have coming out of this program. They learn all of the essentials to understand the use of the medications, the psychotropics they're going to use, to recognize the fact that there are interactions with these drugs and other drugs, to recognize the importance of knowing any underlying medical conditions. The way this bill is currently constructed, there's conversation with a primary care physician, so this is covering it too. But I was really impressed with the degree of medical information, non-psychiatric, non-psychological medical information provided in this program. I think it's an outstanding program. As I watched the evolution of mental health care in rural Oregon, when I came there, I was the psychiatrist because there was nobody else there. Then we got finally talked a psychologist into coming, and then finally a psychiatrist into coming. It's hard to get into psychiatrist in rural Oregon. It's hard to get into psychologist, but there are a lot more there now. And with this added tool, and this is what I see, this is the evolution. I've seen so many changes in medicine over the last 50 years. But with greater understanding of mental illness and psychotropic medication, psychologists now need to have that additional tool. And I think this bill provides that tool in a very timely fashion. It's time to come and make this new growth. So I support this bill very strongly.
Thank you very much for coming.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linnea Lindsay. I'm a clinical psychologist from Hood River, Oregon, where I've practiced for over 17 years with the great Dr. Wade to my left as one of our great family physicians. I want to speak today about the issue of competence. The issue of competence has become the standard in medical care about whether a person can prescribe or practice medicine. I've given you a 5-page sheet that you can read at your leisure, a lot of detail, but I want to give you some visuals. I did complete the program through California Professional School of Psychology. I drove into Portland every third weekend for Saturdays and Sundays in a classroom with my peers, satellite linked to a live picture of a professional in California, or sometimes with the professional in our classroom, able to interact with all my classroom peers, able to ask questions, had the PowerPoints up on our slides, and we're able to even link to the web to look at circulatory systems or how cells morph, that kind of thing. The first class I took was anatomy and physiology. We did study how bodies are bodies. We need to know those things in order to be able to perform the work we do. We also took Guide to Physical Examination and Assessment. Another big issue, let me tell you, dermatology is very interesting, but you don't really want to look at the pictures too often. We studied all kinds of neuroanatomy, physiology. We studied how to look at clinical labs, how to order clinical labs, how to review clinical labs. We studied any other kind of interpretation of diagnostic tests. We studied when psychological problems mask medical disorders. We look at issues of how to look at what might look like it is a depressive issue but might be an issue of endocrinology. Those are differential diagnoses. We know how to rule out, we know how to consult, and we certainly know how to ask questions when we don't know what we're looking at, and we refer at any moment. I have been in some ways a de facto prescriber in rural Oregon because of the work I've done on the medical staff. I was for 11 and a half years the director of the outpatient mental health services of Providence Hood River Hospital. I developed that program and brought in other professionals. But every day I would have a primary care physician call me and say, what medication do you want for this patient? What do you want? How would you titrate it? How would you cross it over? What are the drug-drug interactions? How would you look at that in light of their sleep disorder or their cardiovascular history? There is no way that you can practice prescribing without knowing these things. It would be unconscionable for us to do that, and so we have pursued an education that can establish this competence. I think House Bill 2702 speaks to this, and I highly urge you to consider it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for coming.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just to make sure I'm following this conversation carefully, we have a bunch of amendments in front of us. Do you feel the bill as written without amendment is the one you're referring to, or are you talking about the dash 4 amendments?
Without the amendment, sir.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. And I'd like to call forward Tim Murphy, Bill Derher, Rick Bingham, and is Dr. Collins still here? Kristen Collins. So those are the last of the opponents. So if all four of you could give yours, and then we'll end up with the last group. Probably last group of proponents. We'll end up with the proponents. Go ahead.
Yeah, my name is Rick Bingham. I'm a pediatric physician psychiatrist. I work here in Salem, and I'm coming as the president of an organization called OCAP, which is the Oregon chapter of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. And I wanted to start by saying some of my best friends are psychologists. That's no joke, really. Actually, it includes my wife, Julie Bingham, who's a clinical psychologist. So I'm going to come at this from quite a different angle than I think we've had today. And I'm going to start with the area of agreement, and including that which was outlined by Representative Bill Kenemer, which is that all said and done, if this bill passes, we will have 95% of the patients in Oregon getting their mental health care through their primary care setting in collaboration with mental health clinicians. So my message to you is that if we really want to improve the care of people in Oregon in terms of mental health care, what we need to do is to strengthen mental health primary care integration. Senator Dr. Bates has an integration, a fiscal integration bill that he's introduced. This is related but different. What we're talking about here is clinical integration. And clinical integration provides improved access through three ways. One is through ready access to consultation from a medical specialist, a psychiatrist. Number two, for primary care physicians. Number two is that over time, primary care physicians, who, as we've heard, for a variety, a host of reasons, have not received full and adequate enough training in primary care psychiatry, will gradually increase their expertise through a process of education and consultation. And three, mental health clinicians, including, very importantly, psychologists, will come into primary care practices as full-time members of the team, so-called co-location of mental health clinicians. So the legislation, you all, as legislators, have begun a process. I need to give a little bit of background. So the reasons for this current gap, and there indeed is a gap in terms of mental health in primary care, it's a gap that would not be wished for by the people of Oregon, because people in general want their comprehensive care with their trusted primary care physician for, and this includes mild to moderate mental health problems and mild to moderate general health problems. But there's a gap in that knowledge and skill that's been referred to already. So you and the legislature have been already working to fill that gap. The parity legislation is one way that's healing that gap. More recently, work on providing better access coverage for autism could be another example of that. This current situation is really an aberration. It's a current historical aberration, and it comes out of the ancient mind-body split and decades of misunderstanding, stigma and misunderstanding about brain disorders. And so that has sort of resulted in the current situation. And it's through this kind of change that we'd actually be able to accomplish better access, but so much more. I want to emphasize this so much more, and that's in the handout I've given you. And I'd be glad, I'm not going to take time unless you want me to tell you more about the efforts in through a collaboration between the Child Psychiatry State Organization and our sister organization with pediatricians in the state that we've worked on for over 2 years that's focused on this area of integration. I will only mention that we have ready now in its third draft a concrete proposal that we are presenting to insurers that would address this, the first of the three parts I talked about in terms of mental health care integration, which is the psychiatrist consultation.
in our major healthcare reform, House Bill 2009, we are definitely looking at the primary care home model, and that is something that we definitely are advocating for. We don't know what we'll get through the Ways and Means.
That's
process,
good.
But thank you.
That's good, and I hope you will look at sort of what's more in sync with that, the 2702 versus something like this mental health care integration. So I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
I have a video, so did you want to go?
Sure. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Murphy, and I have some good news. I'm neither a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I'm a clinically trained child and family therapist with 25 years' experience in the mental health treatment, both in the public and the private sectors. In addition, I've served the last 12 years as a hospital administrator, a CEO, and a consultant to hospitals and healthcare agencies. In 2004, I served on Governor Kitzhaber's Adolescent Suicide Task Force, and in 1996 on the Governor Kitzhaber's Task Force, and in 2004 was appointed by Governor Kulongowski, where we created the Mental Health Blueprint for Action and Mental Health Reform. I'm here today to speak about 2007 and 2000 House Bill 2702. I don't entirely oppose the concept, but I do oppose the bill as it's currently written. I believe it puts Oregonians at risk. There's a reason that only two states in our country have allowed psychologists to obtain prescriptive privileges. And when you look at the data, that 94%, that means 94% of the country has not yet found a way to write a bill that meets the standards of both the psychologists and the medical practitioners. Without proper training and supervision and regulatory oversight, we're creating a health risk with a bill like this. And so what I would encourage you to do is to look at the bill and be involved in some pushback so that we can increase the training requirements, increase the supervision requirements, and increase the regulatory oversight. In 2004, with the Mental Health Task Force, we actually discussed this idea, and it was rejected at that time as it was not safe for Oregonians. In 2006, while serving in Hawaii, the similar bill, funded by the pharmaceutical industry, passed both houses of legislature in Hawaii and was vetoed by Governor Linda Lingle when she made the determination that it was not safe, as that bill was written, for the people of Hawaii. In the 25 years of practice, the work that we do, oftentimes we use a multidisciplinary team model where a patient comes together with a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a nurse, a therapist, a social worker, who work collaboratively to understand the issues that the patient is having, to develop a collaborative diagnosis, and build a treatment plan. And that is a holistic approach that crosses disciplines. It's a multidisciplinary approach that serves the patient and the patient's family very well. The problem that will occur if this bill passes as written is that the private sector will most likely continue to provide this level of care, but it's the public sector that will change. This bill, while not intending to do so, will contribute to creating a lower standard of care for our more vulnerable populations that will encourage publicly funded services to employ psychologists rather than physicians to diagnose and medicate patients. Here's a simple test. If your parent, your spouse, or your child were seriously ill and needed treatment, would you take them to a medically trained physician, or would you take them to a psychologist who practices medicine by prescribing drugs? You may have that choice, but if this bill passes, most folks in the public sector will not have that choice. A bill may be crafted to limit medications prescribed. A sad truth of our work is that most of the time, people suffering from symptoms of mental illness also suffer from serious primary care issues as well, hypertension, heart disease. The provisions in this bill that require coordination between a psychologist and a primary care physician with regards to a patient's medical condition are vague. While the bill provides some training in psychopharmacology, it does not provide any training with regards to primary care. This means this bill as written would allow a psychologist to prescribe medications for a psychiatric symptom without any regard for the effect on a person who is taking medications for their primary health care needs. At this point, the bill is written. I urge you to either reject the bill or send it back to committee for more work. It's bad medicine for Oregon. It's unsafe for Oregonians. There were.
We need to. You need to hurry up. We're running out of time.
Okay. I'm fine. Thank you
okay.
very much for your time.
Thank you. Sorry. We're running down the wire. We want to make sure we hear everybody.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is William Dean, and I'm a psychiatric nurse. I'm also a recent graduate of the psychiatric nurse practitioner program in Southwest Washington, and I'm representing a group of psychiatric nurses that came together to make a presentation for you. I think I just hit play. Is that right? Okay.
Psychiatric nurses licensed to practice in Oregon. There are many differences between psychiatry and psychology in terms of functional roles within the healthcare system and in academic preparation. If we consider academic preparation alone, we can see that nurse practitioners who work in mental health, along with all other professionals who have attained prescriptive authority in the state of Oregon, are required to take basic science and health science prerequisites prior to and independent of their professional training. This preparation may take anywhere from 1 to over 2 years of intense study at a college level prior to application to professional training. This is viewed as a minimum and necessary standard. It not only provides a common starting ground for health professionals, it guarantees that professional students do not encounter basic sciences for the first time at the graduate level of training. These prerequisites also serve to guarantee that the information covered within professional training is not comprised of subjects which would have otherwise been covered had the student taken a general biology course, for example. This is a philosophy espoused by nearly all professional healthcare programs, even those that do not result in prescriptive authority. It is even true for dental hygienists, who are required to take chemistry, biology, anatomy physiology, and microbiology prior to and independent of their professional training. In fact, these prerequisite health science courses are viewed as so important to a healthcare professional's preparation that for most programs, the courses actually have an expiration date. This means that if the course is over 7 years old, for example, the student must repeat the course before he or she may apply to a healthcare program. While students of most healthcare programs take their science prerequisite courses together at the college level, doctoral psychology programs do not require any science courses for entry. And if we consider the standards of two current postdoctoral Masters of Psychopharmacology programs for psychologists, we can see that no science prerequisites independent of psychological study are required. These programs are about 2 years in length and condensed into courses that are held in 1 weekend per month. This requires for a psychologist to learn, as their curriculum states, clinical biochemistry and medical pathophysiology, among other health sciences, at the graduate level in 1 weekend per month, and without the benefit of a single science prerequisite course, independent of their psychology training. Then, in the time that remains of the program, the student attempts to learn an advanced practice medical specialty in 1 didactic weekend a month. We do not believe that this level of didactic training is consistent with the level of training received by other professionals whose studies result in prescriptive authority. The debate on prescriptive authority for psychologists often focuses upon healthcare shortages in rural areas, as well as the physical and emotional injuries suffered by American soldiers. These issues pose serious challenges for many branches of healthcare. But the solutions to these problems do not lie in sacrificing the preparatory standards of providers. The issues are laden with emotion, but emotional or fear-based decision-making on any level of problem-solving rarely leads to quality care, and Oregonians deserve quality care from experts who are willing to collaborate in all fields. We believe that Oregon psychologists who are interested in treating patients with pharmaceuticals should propose a plan that includes the same prerequisite courses that every other non-physician prescriber is required to take prior to and independent of their professional training. An education in basic health sciences prior to learning any advanced practice medical specialty is the safe and responsible thing to do. We thank our honorable legislators for considering our message.
Thank you. And one quick question. Do you know about the veterans who died because of misprescribing through the VA? I need to find the source. I read it in the paper. Okay, we'll deal with that later then. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Chris, Dr. Collins, and then we'll end up with Glenn Alley, Laura Smith, Robin Henderson, and Karen Cormick-Jones.
My name is Kristen Collins, and I'm a pediatrician and an adolescent medicine physician in Northeast Portland. I've been here for 18 years and tell people I'm a naturalized Oregonian. I am like Dr. Bates, or I believe it's Dr. Bates, Senator Bates, who spoke earlier about flip-flopping on this issue. And I can tell you the conversations that I've had with people prior to coming here were very one-sided. And sitting here in this room, first of all, I have to tell you, I have a much greater respect for this process than I had before I came. Thank you for all being so careful. It is very clear to me that the representatives that have spoken here are working hard to consider what's best for Oregonians, and I appreciate that. I'm not here on either side. I actually can't, I'm technically in opposition of House Bill 2702, but in reality, I just want to make a few comments about what it's like to be a pediatrician, kind of caught in the middle between access and yet having good relationships with my psychological colleagues. I actually would welcome the bill for access. I had a teenager approached, come into my office last week, made an appointment for a cold. She said, I'm not really here for a cold. I need a pill to help me with my anxiety. What am I supposed to do when she's a work-in and I've got all these other patients in front of me who've made their appointments well in advance? It's a very, very difficult situation. On the other hand, excuse me, I didn't expect to become emotional, but I believe in this. On the other hand, this is a young woman who it was seeing a psychologist, a well-trained psychologist in Portland, who I know, and yet I was completely unaware that she was seeing this psychologist. This young woman has very little support from her parents. She's 17 years old. She's been the victim of a rape. She deserves appropriate mental health care. And yet this psychologist told her to pick up the phone and call me and ask me to prescribe the medication, never once picking up the phone herself to ask me if I would help in this process. I call every psychologist that I interact with my patients, and I have maybe one or two in my 18 years who have ever called me. I would love to work with that gentleman from New Mexico who talked about collaboration and how important it is, but in reality, it does not happen. And Senator Bates made a very good point about psychologists being able to recognize mental illness when it presents in front of them versus chronic illness or an underlying physical form. I have never talked to a psychologist who feels confident in their ability to recognize medical issues. They always ask me to help them sort that out. So while it was brought to you at the beginning of this session that these individuals may very well be, that we should respect the amount of medical training that they have coming to this point, I'm not so sure if you interviewed a variety of psychologists that they would feel very confident in that process. What I'm asking you is to be very, very careful about the legislation that you put forward. It's very clear to me that you're doing that. I feel that allowing the psychologist to come forward with a bill that allows them to train in a facility where they do not have direct interactions with other medical providers will only continue to widen this gap that we have. In my office, I've had the luxury of having a child psychiatrist do her master's thesis in our office for a year, and now we co-locate with a psychiatric mental health, couldn't the state have come up with a better name for these guys? Psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. It really is a problem. It is absolutely wonderful experience. But to allow psychologists to train in a silo and then go out and work in a silo and expect that they will interact within the medical community, it just isn't going to happen. So please take that consideration. And I feel so much for the Oregonians who stepped up and talked about how they wish that their psychologist would have been able to prescribe for them. And I respect that the New Mexico psychologist talked about the tools they have. We need them as part of our team. But they cannot be trained separately. They must be trained in collaboration, or elsewise we'll create more problems than good.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
Well, good morning. My name is Glenn Alley. I am a prescribing psychologist from the state of Louisiana. I'm one of the guinea pigs happens to be a prescribing psychologist for the past 5 years. I'm on active medical staff at a 340-bed general hospital. I'm on medical staff at a freestanding rehabilitation hospital. I happen to be a neuropsychologist as well. I'm on medical staff at a long-term acute care facility. My practice is basically a hospital practice. And in that hospital practice, I collaborate all the time with medical professionals. To allay some of the fears that we just heard, the training of Louisiana psychologists was provided by those who teach our medical students. It was provided by the university professors from our medical school and from our pharmacy school, so that the collaboration started at the very beginning, from the training through the prescriptive authority. Our bill, like your bill, has a mandatory consultation and collaboration clause, such that we must collaborate with physicians at every step of the way. Not only in prescribing medications, but in switching medications, changing doses of medications, we are mandated to consult and collaborate with our physician colleagues. Just one very quick story to, I guess, illustrate how sometimes necessity is mother of invention kind of thing. As part of the general hospital, there is an 18-bed psychiatric unit on which I work. That was medical director is a psychiatrist and another psychiatrist involved. Over the course of about 6 months, one of the psychiatrists quit, leaving the medical director alone. The medical director had previously been staunchly opposed to psychologists having prescriptive authority. However, now the medical director was left on call by himself. Guess who he approached to cover call with him? So sometimes, exactly. So that one of the things that we heard is the training is inadequate. The training has evolved over time. This is not something that just developed by whim or whimsy. This is something that has evolved from the DOD program, as you heard earlier on, to what works in the states. You've heard before, the proof is definitely in the pudding. This has been done. It is not something that we are speculating about. All of the speculation about the fears, as far as I know, I left yesterday, as far as I know, there are no people dead in the streets in Louisiana from medical psychologists prescribing. They're still safe. We're still doing it in the safest possible manner. And one other point, the point about access. Access is not just rural versus urban. Access is also a problem when a patient has to wait 6 weeks to 6 months for an appointment. That's an access problem, okay? So it can be in urban areas as well. I work at a community mental health center as well. I give 2 days a week to my community mental health center. One of the charges of our governor when she signed our bill was, you guys will provide care to the indigent, you guys will provide community care. I work 2 days a week in my community mental health center. I take a position that has been unfilled for over 5 years because we cannot find psychiatrists to fill these positions. It's not that we're fighting for turf. Psychiatrists are busy in my area. They're not losing patients. They're gaining patients. Okay. That's not the issue. The issue is there are plenty of patients to go around. Not a problem. You know the statistics. You know that our gross national, our funding for health care has expanded from 1970, 1980 from 7% gross national product to 17% health care. Mental health care in that same period has gone from 0.54% to 0.95%. So we're doing a dismal job of providing mental health care to our patients across the country, not just in Oregon, Louisiana, where have you. This is not the solution. Giving psychologists prescriptive authority is not the solution to the access problem. It's a step in the right direction, but it's not the solution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So far, they haven't called us to the floor. We're supposed to be on the Senate floor, so.
Yes, ma'am. Well, I can come back at 3:30 if you'd like.
Let's wait till they call
okay,
us.
Okay, I'll call go. Us. I just want to hit the high points. I'm Dr. Robin Henderson. I'm a licensed psychologist. I work in an acute psychiatric facility, the only acute psychiatric facility east of the Cascades. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for your patience with this bill. Thank you for the good and thorough hearing that you've given us today. I just want to hit some high points about the bill itself and discuss a few of the concerns that Senator Monis Anderson has raised and answer any questions that you may have in closing. Our bill has gone significantly better through this course of the work group. We had a work group when it was in Representative Greenlick's committee that had family nurse practitioners, it had a primary care physician, it had psychiatrists and psychologists. So the contention that we've not been collaborative in the development work on this bill is not exactly accurate. The psychiatrist also called in Kathy DeCampos, a nurse practitioner from the Kaiser Permanente system in January to work with us in January 2009 to work with us in our interim negotiations. So we have reached out to other disciplines to craft what is now what I believe to be a good bill. We are mandated to have primary care collaboration. We are mandated when we prescribe to children to consult with a pediatrician psychiatrist, somebody who can treat children. Those are law. We have to document that. Our board will check that. We have a committee on prescribing psychologists who oversee the formulary, the curriculum. They can make changes. They can recommend changes to the curriculum. We have agreed with Senator Bates that we will add one more physician to that committee, giving the physicians the power in a 7-member committee. If 4 are physicians, 3 are not. That's where the oversight comes from. And they will have the certification and the disciplinary authority over this process. We made that agreement with Senator Bates and are working on that amendment, getting that amendment worked out. We're almost there, I'm sure. The time really is now. I live in a rural area, and okay, it's not rural, but I have the only psychiatric facility in 32,000 square miles, and I want to tell you a little piece about when I first got to Bend 8 years ago, and the primary care and family practice docs were the only people treating the mentally ill in my hospital, and they came in and they said, Robin, we're done. Guess what? You better get some psychiatrists in here because we're done. We're not going to treat them anymore. They are outside our scope of practice. And they showed me a lawsuit from Texas where a physician had been sued for treating a mentally ill patient who was not a psychiatrist and did not have a background in mental health and said, we will not see them in your hospital anymore. Figure it out. In that interim, at that time, I had one psychiatrist. I've recruited probably 30 psychiatrists in my career, at least. And let me tell you, I think I've paid more membership dues for John's organization over there. Psychiatrists are very dear friends of mine, and I have a lot of respect for them. This isn't about psychiatry. It's about the other 85% of our people who are begging and crying for help. I believe that when we put that piece in there about physician collaboration, we're mandating what you're talking about. And you're correct. You are correct. Sometimes practitioners, solo practitioners, get stuck in a vacuum. That's why this bill doesn't apply to all psychologists. It only applies to those who want to work in this collaborative model, who want to take this additional step. I haven't taken this training. It's not my intention to. But I'm a girl who works in acute psychiatric facilities who struggles every day to staff them. I signed an agreement with a psychiatrist who's coming on board in August. Look for his membership application soon. And in September, another one of my psychiatrists will leave my practice, and I'll be down again. It's tough out there, and I need more arrows in my quiver. I need more bandwidth. And I believe this bill gives us that.
Chair Montes Anderson, you asked about the fiscal and why there was the difference in the fiscal. In 2007, the board and the OPA did not agree on the formula for the committee, and there was a large fiscal in there because there was some misunderstanding about how that worked. We worked with the Board of Psychologist Examiners to iron that stuff out so they understood what we were asking for, and they also found funding to hire another staff member. So they did not need the additional funding. That's why the fiscal changed. The APA has given a grant to fund the work of the committee solely for the effort.
The APA is the American
Psychological Association. Mm-hmm. My apologies. That is just for the committee work during the first 18 months. They will have no funding involved when we get to actual certification and disciplinary action. So that's startup costs only. You also asked about the veteran. And we did research all of the articles we could find yesterday. We did find one about a veteran. Do know that prescribing psychologists are not practicing in the VA at this time. And so the case that you are in also do not practice in any state with methadone. Methadone has never been on the formulary for any prescribing psychologist and won't be. So the case that I believe you're referencing both involved a VA hospital and methadone, so it did not involve our practitioners. But it did give us an interesting opportunity to look into the record.
And it shows how complex these people can be, yeah. All right, we really need to get to the floor. So I know there's, Laura says she doesn't need to prescribe.
Are there any questions?
I'm a little bit proud of you.
How about, I forgot one brief thing.
One thing for the record, yeah.
One brief thing for the record. You had asked about the current DOD program, and I do want to say that the Oregon model is the current model accepted for credentialing in the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. It is the current DOD program. The two-year program, the two-year doctor degree, or postmaster's degree from any of the six institutions, clinical supervision, and passage of the national examination is accepted for credentialing in the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. That is the same as Oregon's program, so Oregon is the current Department of Defense standard.
There is no more DOD program.
Okay, I have some questions on that, but we don't have time to do that right now.
I'll be back at 3:30.
We will be carrying this bill over, and I do want to state that we did get written testimony from the Oregon Medical Association in opposition. This bill is not going away, and I thank you, everyone, so much for being here. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on 2702.
Thank you.
And we're adjourned.
Recess.
Recessed
until 3:30.
Until 3:30.